Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
MLS.
The Cutest.
You're back in 2006. And why the hell is Imran late again?
Because it's tradition.
And why are all these strange people here? Who are they?
Well, I think Dan's still here, but he's awfully quiet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I was waiting something.
Dan?
I'm in a time warp.
Are you doing the time warp? What?
Bad mental imagery.
You need to put sound effects in here. I don't know how I'm meant to resist this.
I was about to say that I would show you a time warp, but I don't know what that means.
I think it involves fishnet stockings, so no, we don't want to say that.
What? What are you putting on me? Oh my god.
Mackie's already thinking about it, plus one.
I'm trying not to think of it.
It sounds like a negative culture modifier.
Yes.
Yes. Your borders actually shrink.
So yes, I'm here, and who's everyone else that's here, Wetter, you know, other than yourself?
I don't know these people. I guess we have Maki.
Oh, 5 years. Dan has been making me get up too freaking early on weekends. Ugh.
You're welcome.
Whose fault is that?
Not enough. There's not a pot of coffee big enough.
Yeah, I know all about that. But we also have Demian Team.
It only looks like I'm doing something illegal.
And wait. Michael Lucas Smith.
Actually, I'm here to replace Lisa this week. Wait, what? No. Okay, hang on. Wait, okay. Yeah.
Well, why don't we get this one off with a bang then? This thread is started by Kronos I or Kronos 1, probably Kronos 1, that would be my guess, and it is titled, "In Multiplayer, Do You Think It Is Cheating?" And because this is a bit of a TLDR post in that it's a block of text, I'll try and summarize it for you guys. Basically, this is a Civ4 topic, and Kronos is saying that he made a tech trade deal with his friend in multiplayer, and he doesn't tell us what he traded to get engineering, but he said that he traded for engineering from his friend, and his friend requested that he not trade engineering around himself until his friend finishes Notre Dame. So now it's been a few turns, he's starting to fall behind in tech, and he still can't trade engineering, and his friend still hasn't even started Notre Dame, and instead of like threatening him in game, because he's not in a position to threaten him in game, he simply threatened his friend, the Kronos One, basically is being threatened that if he trades engineering around, his friend will be upset. Seriously, like that's the bargaining position we're going with here, and so basically Kronos One here is looking for advice, or you know, something along those lines of advice in terms of what he should do in the situation. Should he just trade engineering around and say to hell with his friend and his being upset, or should he maybe consider not trading engineering or whatever? And this is kind of a little bit of a polarization on the topic, but for the most part, people are saying screw that, just trade the technology, and that you know, conduct in games isn't something to be upset over. And not only that, the spirit of the deal is broken because the guy isn't even trying to build Notre Dame. So you can make an argument that his friend is trying to undermine him by simply not building Notre Dame and shackling him from being able to trade the technology. So that's my take on it. But
listen,
guys,
Phil,
welcome.
Phil, I'm going to need your land.
Where have I heard this before?
I need your technology.
You know, if they haven't started this game with the idea that they're going to work together, then he's just been taken as a fool, right? But if they are trying to work together, then his friend's just not playing very well.
Yeah.
Hey, all is fair in love and Civ.
There's some incentive in a free-for-all Civ game to hold on to your partners temporarily, even if you ultimately can only have one winner, just because any type of negotiation you have between you and that guy increases both of your chances of winning and decreases the other player's chance of winning. So you do have some incentive to form partnerships temporarily, work with each other, even if your end goal is to win by yourself. But man, if someone's undermining you strictly through doing deals, that's probably not the guy you want to partner with. That's probably the guy you want to betray or backstab or otherwise screw over. So, yeah. And I'm not real keen on the "I'm going to be upset with you if you don't play the way I want you to play" threat. That's not a childish.
You say, "Well, I should have given you a time limit. If you don't start building Notre Dame within 30 turns, I'm trading it."
Yeah, because that worked so well for Bethesda and Interplay.
Well, you finish this thing or else.
Nothing this guy's friend can do to stop him from trading it, though. He has no ability.
I'll give you engineering, and if you can't raise 2,000 gold in the next 30 turns, then you get no rights to this other tech.
That would definitely be entertaining as a multiplayer game with negotiations along those lines.
I would sign it with the full intent to never actually accept it.
Again, it goes back to how long you want this person to be your partner. It's just a question of that, I suppose. And by that, I mean in-game. Nobody should be getting upset over in-game conduct. I mean, if you don't like the way somebody's playing a game, maybe you don't play with them next time or whatever. But seriously, getting angry over it, come on now. It's pretty lame. Even the AI doesn't do that. It's clean slate the next game. And if you can't even manage the AI's conduct, I don't know what to say.
Although I will say, if you're getting that worked up about what's going on in-game, then your quote-unquote real life must be pretty darn good, because I think there are other things that we could be spending our time worried about. But, you know, all of this conversation is actually reminding me of one part of a post in particular in this thread from Archon Ring, which is number one rule of Civ: don't trust anybody, and humans are even worse than AIs.
I actually think that if you're getting this upset over a cooperative game of Civ, you must be on Skype with them.
What are you talking about? I've never heard of such issues with online co-op in Skype. No, not even once.
Not every Saturday night or anything, nope.
I totally didn't build Sistine Chapel this game, I swear. It's just natural culture pressing your cities. No, I'm not the one poisoning your water.
You have no proof.
Yeah.
No, I'm the only other person on your continent, but you have no proof.
It's all right. This privateers must belong to somebody else. I have no idea how I got this great general. I must have finished fascism or something. There you go.
Yeah, the AI is actually shipping spies over from another continent. Yep. Even though we still have never.
And they're the ones building all the privateers. The AI definitely does that. They have those stacks of, four, five, six privateers blockading always, all the time.
If you're going to be playing by some house rules here in a cooperative situation, you're going to make rules, then decide on what the consequences are going to be before the start of the game. If one person is really upset about what's happened afterwards, then either don't continue playing with that individual, just decide, we can be friends, but, not in the game, that doesn't work. And discuss what your concerns are afterwards. And if you can't come to an agreement, or if you realize someone is, really annoying you, then you could take the choice to remove yourself from the game, if it's to that extreme. Because if you're getting that worked up in-game, then you might as well remove yourself from the situation, because it's just a game. It's not worth it. But I definitely would say that this is not cheating. Depending upon your view, you might think it's not fair, or it's not appropriate, or it's taking advantage, but that's all very subjective. Deal with it afterwards.
This is sort of a high school drama sort of thread in many ways. And Dan's advice makes a lot of sense. Get over it. Grow a thicker skin. Don't play with someone you don't like again. So on and so forth.
Well, for all we know, that might be exactly what's going on, too. I mean, we don't really know the backgrounds of either of these players. But even so, when it comes to in-game conduct, at the end of the day, it's something that you should get over no matter what.
Next week on Glee... Oh, no.
if the term
spread culture espionage mission, Kronos, the spread culture espionage mission.
The question is the Civ leak, is that a thing now?
Well, like WikiLeaks, except for Civ, or
no, it's the Gleek for Civ.
Oh,
yeah, I'm hoping it never becomes a thing.
You said you do hope it becomes a thing, or you hope it never becomes.
Never, never.
They don't say anything about it over on the air. No, I didn't even know what it was.
Civ Leak should never become a thing. Just never talk about Civ Leak ever again.
Current listener, please ignore MLS. He is trying to corrupt society or inadvertently causing the corruption of the society. Either way, we'll deal with that as needed.
Airports and airlifting. A couple of threads, actually. The first one by KWebs10. I was thinking the other day, comparing previous versions of Civ to Civ 5 and the lack of air units. For me, as my civilization expands, and I usually play on large to very large maps, it gets increasingly difficult to conduct warfare across the vast expanses of the map. One of the perks of modern warfare in the previous games was the use of airlifts to bring units closer to war as possible. What are your thoughts? Am I missing something? I, for one, believe that an update should include airlifts to speed up the time, the travel time. I almost said time travel. Speed up the travel times of moving units. The one comment that I was going through the thread that just kind of seemed to disrupt the conversation at one point, but still brought a little smile to my face, was Jay Neat, who was like, "Blitz, blitz everywhere." Someone pointed out that there are the Man of Doom, actually, past podcast guest, pointed out that there are paratroopers, and that railroad movement costs like 1/8 of a movement point, allowing you to zip around your territory with ease. But K-Web says that, yes, you're absolutely correct. I take advantage of both of these, but my concern arises when my units must cross oceans. And there was definitely a divide between agreeing and disagreeing. The argument about disagreeing with it was actually kind of a shift to focus on naval combat, which was they removed airlifts because they wanted to focus on naval combat, to make naval combat more important. And also, because of one unit per tile, the ability to move one unit through an airlift would have a more significant impact than it did in previous versions of Civ, where that one unit could now be on a tile that already had a number of units, so proportionately one unit being able to move was not as significant as it would be now in Civilization V. And those agreeing with the idea said, for example, that it doesn't really take away from the naval aspect of the game as it only comes around in the modern era. Perhaps if airdrops could be intercepted or bombarded, it would make it better, and as you still need to clear the area of threats. So in other words, to be able to have airdrops, you need a beachhead in that situation. And in order to get that beachhead, unless the other person's naval force was next to none, naval combat is still important and becomes actually a prerequisite almost in many situations in order to be able to get that beachhead and then use an airlifting ability. I would like the idea to see airports and airlifting return. I think part because we've talked about paratroopers before, and, you know, in Civilization V, they can paradrop up to 5 tiles from friendly territory. They can move after paradropping if they still have one of their 2 movements left, but they cannot enter combat until the following turn. And while there is use for that, I think if we had the ability to airlift one unit from one city to another city, that would be advantageous in the later game, especially on the larger maps, even though I don't play on those, but also tying into the suggestion that you would need an airport, at least in the city that's going to be airlifting the unit, and then maybe even an airport in the city that is going to be receiving the unit. So that way it becomes a bit more of a strategy rather than simply, I now have this technology and therefore I now have this ability.
It comes back to one of these questions for me of, you know, when you have a tank on the screen, what does that represent? Does that represent a big army of tanks or literally one tank? And when it comes to deploying an army in a foreign country across an ocean, you can't fly the whole thing there. You pretty much have to sail it there. You know, a carrier can carry a lot of tanks and a lot of troops in one trip, whereas The planes, you do use them to bring specialized equipment, specialized teams, engineers to do specialized jobs. So, you know, I would almost limit it to workers, perhaps, just so the worker micro just disappears. But there is no such thing as a airline fleet big enough to ship over a modern invading army. It just doesn't exist.
I don't know. Well, it wouldn't be cost-effective to do that in real life. But in terms of in-gameplay, I think a lot of the naysayers here have ridiculous reasonings for, like, banning airlifts. I mean, first of all, naval combat, at least since Civ 4 and probably before that, it's been, like, really crucial to gameplay. You had a competent opponent at sea that kind of dominated you there, you were toast on a water map, or even just a continents map. You're done. You're going to lose. Now, in Civ, yeah, you got that one unit per tile argument, but in Civ 4, you could literally airlift from every city you had into one target city as long as the target city had an airport. So you could, like, have 50 units appear in one place. I don't think the increased impact, quote-unquote, of one unit per tile in Civ 5 would break it any differently than that. In fact, if you kept the one unit per tile limitation, you would actually be able to airlift less, and it would have less of an impact. Right, yeah, you have some realism element there, but you also, like, I would advocate, or I would argue that it's pretty hard in the game to have a modern military unit travel across the world within a year. Yet in real life, that's pretty much any reasonably decent military force in the world could get across the world in under a year without any trouble whatsoever, unless, of course, we're engaged in battle. So I think the airlift is something that Civ 5 probably should include. Somebody checked the code. Apparently there is working airlift code or something like that in the game already. Maybe we'll see it in an expansion. I have no idea. But I really don't see any reason not to have it in there. Like, it's not going to ruin naval combat. You're still going to be toast if somebody has you dominated at sea to enough of an extent where they can start capturing all your coastal cities and screw you over. It's not going to change that. You know, that's been pretty well constant throughout the Civ series between experienced players.
I will say I'm also fine and, in fact, would argue that the airlift shouldn't be absolute in the sense that, especially on the larger map, that if the... I don't know how we're going to decide on this, but from, you know, one end of the world to the other, if that city has an airport and another city has an airport, perhaps also from a gameplay standpoint, as well as maybe not so much as a realism standpoint, but from a gameplay standpoint, it could be that just like a paradropper can only paradrop up to 5 tiles outside of friendly territory, that the city that you want to airlift to must be within a certain distance. And that could increase as the game progresses, perhaps, and as you got additional technology, for instance. So that way it wouldn't simply be, oh, all my forces or some of my forces are over here. I want it instantly over there. They may have to chain hop to then go to a city in between that also has an airport. And then the next turn it could complete it. So depending upon the distance, it might not be, yes, I'm able to get this unit to that front in one turn. It might take a turn or two. I'd be fine with that as well.
So you're saying they can't have nonstop flights if it's too far? They have to make connections?
Yes, they have to make connections. But I do think also the ability to say, you know, the number of air units that you could have in a city should be limited. Because someone said here, now I haven't, it's been a long time since I've played, who is it? Soren Aiken said that, where is it here? So when I first played Civ 5, I assumed there was a limit on the number of air units that could be based in each city. It was several playthroughs until I realized that it was unlimited. And back in Civilization 4, without an airport, it was 4. And then if you put in an airport, it went to 8.
Yep.
Yes, but it's more about the airlifting.
You could still get infinite stacked.
It's more about the airlifting. Because an airport, you can only move one unit into the city, fire an airlift. Mm-hmm. But if you put an airport in the destination city, then you can just airlift everything.
Yeah. It's harder to airlift from cities because you can only airlift from one city once per turn. So that was the actual bottleneck. And that was really annoying micro-wise because you would have to fan your units out if you weren't just producing and immediately airlifting to all your cities and then airlift them all into one place again. Really obnoxious and no way to waypoint it or even queue it up. So actually, I found naval shipping in Civ 4 to be easier than airlifting when it came to a micro standpoint. And on things like Earth 18, I would just hop like Brazil to Africa, like West Coast to Africa, and use rail networks to move around otherwise. This is just so much less painful. You could throw down 40 units in two boats at the same time, ship them over in one turn, or like I think like one and a half. You could be unloading and moving in the Western Hemisphere or vice versa with like 50 plus units instead of click, go, click, go, click, go.
Backfill. That's what I use it for, because getting your reinforcements over there means you've got to sail all the way back and then sail back again, back and forth, back and forth. During that sail time, you use airlifts to put units into the cities that you've captured so you can move your more combat-ready units forward. That's what I use it for.
That is useful, but you can also bring your reinforcements up along the coast and invade with them and then bolster your army that way. And really, the main benefit of the airlift in that case is just it pushes up some of your production by usually only five turns at most, even on huge maps. If you have rail set, you can get to a major port town and then ship it over very quickly. And it's the same thing, like someone said, with rails in Civ 5. Rails are huge in both games. But yeah, it's useful to drop like an extra garrison unit or something. Unfortunately, captured cities usually don't retain the airport, so you can't just drop in like 30 units, unfortunately.
No.
And the threat also, the whole discussion also reminded me of how in Civilization 4, you took a worker or workers and you built a fort on a tile. You could station air units there.
Yeah, but it really should have been called like a military outpost or a military base or something like that, because that's how it worked. You know, a military base would have a modern military base would have an airstrip, but you know, it's more like fortifying the land for military rather than a fort.
Specifically, I started thinking about that, and then that actually came up as part of a second thread and a more recent thread started by Soren Erkin. Specifically on that, his fourth suggestion was an airbase, which was a tile improvement constructed by a worker that allows air units to be based there, can be constructed in enemy territory to create a forward air base.
Yeah, but what about my nuclear silo? I want to be able to do the same with that.
Yeah, because nukes aren't already by far the strongest thing in both games.
You know, I like the idea of being able to, you know, like a tile improvement, but the fact that you could say that you could have your worker in enemy territory and building an air base, I mean, I know realistically possible, especially if they have, you know, some military defending them. I'm not so certain, though, about in gameplay, but being able to do that in enemy territory, but certainly in your own territory, so long as you weren't able to put infinite number of air units onto the terrain improvement, even if it was defended by a single unit, if that also had a limit, say, four as well, then that would be fine. And then, of course, then the question would then become, if you construct an airfield, then perhaps the consequence of that would be that whatever else you have on that terrain, whatever improvement is there, is destroyed. It's not like, ooh, let's put a trading post on top of jungle. That you actually would destroy whatever that improvement would happen to be, and that would be the choice.
Just so the listeners know, it is possible to get infinite air power in Civ 4 onto one tile. All you have to do is spam carriers, and since there's no one unit per tile rule, you can just put as many carriers as you want on the tile and then as many fighters or jet fighters as you want on the tile. And actually, people used to complain about that for a little while. It wasn't very long, probably just a couple months on the forums, that you had infinite air power near coast, but you just couldn't match that inland or from defending cities. So the attacker actually had an advantage there. But then again, an attacker has advantage with nukes too, so whatever.
Yeah, come on. If the attacker has 20 carriers filled to the brim with fighters, I think it's safe to say they do indeed have an advantage.
Yeah, and like I said, one nuke, I mean, come on, it's going to completely ruin that force.
This person also suggested an international airport, which was an upgrade to the airport that permits multiple or unlimited aircrafts per turn, unlimited range. Whoa, let's forget about this unlimited stuff. An aerial... It's like, whoa, wait a minute. Aerial Combat Training Academy provides bonus experience to only air units. I think let's just tie that into an airport. Like in Civilization 4, if you built an airport, then your air units got +3 experience. There's where you can get experience for your units before they enter into combat, just like a barracks for land units and civil, also thinking of civilization for barracks and stable for a mounted unit. There's also a restore air unit abilities, recon, tile improvement bombing, and precision bombing of city buildings. And he says that precision bombing has a low success rate by default. City buildings can never be completely destroyed by precision bombing, only damaged and temporarily disabled until they were repaired. And so I started thinking, okay, yes, we do have the repair ability in Civ 5 of a worker that if you build an improvement and it gets pillaged, you don't have to start from scratch again, as it were. The repair is like half the time or something like that is building it from scratch. But being able to specifically target a building to destroy, I don't know about that. How about just you have the possibility of damaging some particular building? Either that's going to be really good strategy, or I know it's later game, or that could be really crippling strategy if someone had a whole bunch of precision bombings for, you know, your significant economic buildings, like your banks, for example.
Can you do that? Well, not at war, because if you can't, then there's no point. Well, if you have bombers, why don't you just bomb the city's defenses down and capture it? That makes all their buildings go away from their control. Well, okay, do we have anything else regarding this topic, or should we move along to the next one, which is to be addressed by a certain someone who might have something to do with the topic directly?
What, you think of me and you think of food?
Sexist.
You know, cook, right?
Well, I do, and I guess the guys, since I played Minecraft, if you guys see me and you think cake or something.
I guess I'm thinking more along the lines of caffeine, but yeah, no. Food works.
Well, back over on the 2K forums again, Project VRD had started a thread about, can you share food between the entire civilization? He's like, it's basically what the title says. He's completed the tech tree, but it appears each city must still make its own food from its own farms, fishing tiles, and everything. And he says he would have thought that that would not be the case in this day and age. That sort of thing never happens in an advanced nation. Well, Civ has mostly always had it be that each city produced its own food. I think in 1 and 2 we had the caravans that could carry food, but before modern times, you had some food sharing, but not a lot of food sharing. It's only when you get into, like, refrigeration and trucking that we start moving everything across the country.
Yeah, when you get up to roads actually, when the rail was invented, that's when farming became a nationwide thing. But when you talk about refrigeration for frozen preserved goods instead of spice preserved goods, then you kind of get massive food sharing like that. So there is definitely technology playing into this. And, you know, again, I would say it's a matter of, hey, that's late game. No one ever plays that anyway.
well, it's true.
Well, some extent,
ancient Rome wasn't fed from Italian soil. I mean, the food came all the way from the other side of the empire there as well. I mean, you see that throughout history. So historically, that's a point there, but historically, if you zoom in on any part of civilization, it falls apart pretty quickly. So, yeah, sorry, that's just not the kind of game that Civ is, if you ask me.
Yeah, how would you make a working model of food sharing? And then how would you design your AI to use it even halfway decently? You know, it's something that I guess is worth considering, but within the Civ model with the tile improvements meaning so much and how you determine the quality of a city, I think you would need really a rework of the fundamental gameplay in order to include something like that. It's otherwise, you know, you just settle a city into the hills and ship food over there, and it almost doesn't matter what cities go where, because you can just food share and then build production wherever you get it.
Seriously,
that's exactly what's happening in the real world.
Well, so what, though? I mean, I'm talking about in-game play when you're trying to make a balanced terrain set or something that actually applies strategy and city placement and when you're building your city improvements and whatever.
You
might be able to make it work, but I think you would really have to rework the game fundamentally.
Yeah, because exactly. If you wanted to have it in there, you'd have to have some sort of formula like X number of farm gives you an extra food per turn for all cities. And then, you know, maybe it would be like the maritime bonuses, the city-state bonuses, and it goes up with each era to reflect that you have better methods of preservation and better methods of transportation.
I wouldn't put it up with each era. I'd just put it up with particular technologies. And it's a bit like having a Sid Sushi that gets better over time that isn't limited to just sushi, right?
That's really dangerous, though, because when you start doing stuff like that, you start getting balls rolling down the hill effect. Like, what is it called? Slippery slope? Yeah, that's the trope. It's anybody who gets pulled out of tech lead just increases his advantage that much further. And there's already enough of that in Civ. Where somebody can start being runaway, but you start adding global food bonuses on top of global science bonuses and, you know, earlier access to wonders and everything else, and not to mention more effective military. You really do have to be careful with that. It starts becoming a game that's decided 50 to 100 turns in when the game lasts 200 turns. And it's not fun to play a game that's over in either direction, whether you're curb stomp winning or you just have no chance already.
Well, you could go back to the Civ 1 and 2 way, which is to have the caravan carry excess food from one city to another. You know, maybe
macro.
A city.
Way too much macro.
Just saying.
You should be able to set up a queue for that, though. Like, Civ 2 was a pretty bad user interface for allowing you to move units without that many inputs. And if there's anybody who can't do it, I would say it's Firaxis, because their user interface for seamless controls in Civ 4 and Civ 5 has been awful. But you should be able to model a caravan system that doesn't require a ton of inputs from the human.
Yeah, and I think there should be food sharing in Civilization. Bring it back. And we don't have to get to the point of refrigeration. I mean, as Butter said earlier and was also pointed in the thread, there was food sharing before refrigeration. It was just what type of food was being shared, and also to a significant degree, how much was being shared. And I think that should in part depend on technology, but it's kind of one of those things to avoid, as Phil's talking about. You get this particular technology, now you have that bonus by obtaining that technology. It's kind of like you research this particular technology, say that, for example, it's like with ironworking. Okay, you now can build swordsmen, except that's not enough just to have the ironworking technology. You also need the iron resource. So, or you could have it that, hey, did you know that you now have banking? You know, your city can give you plus 25% gold or plus 50% gold, I forget exactly right now, in Civ 5. It's not just enough to have that technology. You now have to build the bank. So it gives you a basis for a next step, and you make the choice of whether or not, okay, is it going to be advantageous to get that plus modifier in this city because, oh, this city is producing 5 gold as compared to putting a bank in the city that's giving you plus 25. So you could look at a city that, depending upon where it's settling, you could farm grasslands like crazy and have this incredible surplus. And then you could say, okay, as long as that city is connected to another city by a river or a road, then it would be able to share a certain percentage of that with another city, or perhaps even multiple cities. But this city only has so much food surplus, and until you have a particular surplus, either an absolute amount or a percentage, as far as then being able to grow, then that city is not going to be able to share that. So that way there is some measure of it, and it's throughout the entire game. And Mackie brought up maritime city-states because it's back. It's already kind of in there where the city-states are sharing food with you. So I think it's fair that not only could you be sharing it within cities within your particular empire, but someone also brought up in the thread, and I'll try to find the name to give them credit, also about how that could become a measure in diplomacy as well. So in addition to sharing luxury resources and strategic resources, you could also have it in there for food. And yes, I know now there's something else that you could sell to the AI for a whole bunch of money. I know there's still balancing issues in there, but I think it would be worth the effort that would be required in order to rebalance, to reintroduce that in a way that is practical and realistic and enjoyable in gameplay.
Yeah, I actually think it's an interesting idea, not just for food too, but what if your technology's trade, your technology dictates how far things can travel on your trade network, i.e. rivers and roads and airports and shipping lines and whatnot. So, you know, in the early game, something like a food resource can travel to, which means that it's going to feed the city that you're near, or possibly two cities that you're near. And then as you upgrade, you put in your roads, you put in your river travel, boats, etc., then that distance increases. You know, when you finally get to the end game, it's going to be as big as your continent, possibly even overlapping with some other continents at points. But it would mean that strategic resources like iron, horse, and food all behave the same way as trade networks, essentially. I think it would be really interesting because it allow you to strategically cut off resources that are feeding a nation.
Yeah, but the first time you have to build a city for iron way out in the middle of nowhere and the only place you have a reasonable production rate is in your capital, that's going to suck.
That will require you to consider your strategy, yeah.
You mean the reroll strategy?
Yeah. My only iron is on the other side of the continent. Reroll, guys.
Archer Rush.
Well, that's semi-workable instead of five, actually, as long as you have something else to take back to the city.
Yes, it's way, 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 way more workable in Civ 5 than 4. If you don't have a strategic resource in Civ 4 and your Civ is not named Inca or Mali, or I guess maybe two others, you're not going to do anything.
Yeah, but that's the problem with the map script generation.
Yeah,
it's a whole different topic.
Yeah, it is. Good call. Although it does bleed into food things because it would affect the balance of terrain to be able to share food. It absolutely would. And you would have to alter that dynamically within the current model to even have a chance of the game being reasonable.
Well, you would definitely try and do things differently. Like if you had a large food resource area, you'd want to settle your cities around it to get the most out of that food early on.
Well, that's what always happens. But now, otherwise, terrible sites would suddenly be awesome, even critical. But then does everyone get equal distributions of those? That's what I'm worried about. You just get outproduced or outfooded because of spawns.
Well, that happens.
In other words,
right,
I worry about the current problems. I worry that it would exacerbate that problem, which has been a severe problem that it seems beyond Firaxis's grasp since basically forever.
Well, I mean, since they took over looking after the civilization, right? I mean, strictly speaking, Firaxis since Civilization 3.
Yes. Well, I don't think that they knew how to make balanced spawns prior to Civ 3 and then just forgot and couldn't do it at the start of Civ 3.
See, if you had the trading of food not only within your empire, but also had the ability to have that, you know, through diplomacy, through another civilization, you could decide, for example, that I'm going to be emphasizing on my economy, so I'm going to get myself trading posts everywhere, but in order to be able to use those trading posts, I'm going to need the food. Okay, so now do I try to be dependent on getting a whole bunch of maritime city-states, but those maritime city-states, perhaps because of the advantage then, which is, okay, now you can get the food from somewhere else, and you can also have the gold that you would then have to protect that interest. So that might actually mean, for example, making sure that there is a road between, you know, one city in your empire and that city-state, and then making sure that that city is also connected by road or river to the rest of your network. So then that way you're deciding, okay, depending upon how I roll, especially with the map script, well, I can have lots of production, but there isn't going to be any food. Then now you need to go out and either find a city-state, or you could try to find, you know, a quote-unquote proper AI, where maybe you wouldn't have to do so much in order to connect it, but you've always got that risk of the AI going flaky on you and deciding, this seemed to be a good idea at the time, but now you're getting too powerful, you're building up too well because you are getting all of this food. And if you become too reliant on that, and either they declare war on you or they denounce you and they stop that, now you could be in a situation where now I've got a food deficit, my people are starving, I need to try to replace that with something else. Or you try to go really, you know, you go try to go the other way. You try to be a food exporter, try to control people the other way in terms of cutting off their food supply. Or you try to have a more or less balanced empire, quote unquote, if the map script and your starting position allows it, where you're not reliant on, you know, one way or the other. You're not reliant on somewhere else for food or relying on something else for production or strategic resources. You know, you just have a little bit of excess food that's kind of, you know, supplemental to whatever else you're doing.
You know, there's a silly question here for, we covered the copper, right? If you don't already have copper, then the idea of conquering their land to take their copper is kind of ridiculous. But, you know, we can kind of borrow something from the real world here. Starving people are much more ready to pick up a weapon and go and kill their neighbors than non-starving people. So that is a reason to invade somebody's land to get more food if your people are hungry.
My question is there a balanced way that would allow it to be reasonable, such that the people defending could actually defend, and the people attacking wouldn't just be screwed because they don't have food. Like, I'm envisioning a scenario where I spawn closer to the food than Dan, and I just put two warriors between Dan and the food, and he can't do anything now. He's just going to starve. He can't, because he won't be able to grow his production city by transferring food to it to the point where it could work production. And so it's just, he's screwed. He can't build military, and because he can't build military, he can't break the choke. And eventually, I just take the food city away from him.
I don't think he should get between a Canadian and his poutine.
Maybe
it sounds like Dan's just playing.
It seems to hamper their performance.
I mean, just playing really badly.
Yeah, I mean, you needed to have more skill. You needed to be more skillful with your spawns. You shouldn't have spawned in such a crappy location, Dan. Hypothetically, that is.
No, if we're in that situation like you're talking about, that you've got the food advantage and I've got the production advantage, and I realize that you've blocked me off. That I'm not going to be able to either get that food, either because, you know, we're so close that, you know, I can't get it culturally. I'm not going to be able to, you know, settle for it. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to maybe there's another direction I could go. Like, instead of, you know, if we've got like an eastern border, you're on my east, then I could go to the west to try to find either other land to settle that's better, or a city state or an AI proper that will trade me. But even if I don't have that, then maybe now I need to focus as much as I can on production. And yes, my production is going to be slow, but then I'm needing to think, okay, I'm going to have to emphasize production early on, even though it's a little on the slow side. And in Civilization 5, especially with the ability to buy with gold right from the outset, then maybe I also need to be thinking, I need to be able to, for instance, generate a lot of gold so I can even, you know, my production may not be very high because I can't work many tiles, but I could buy a whole bunch of archers, for example, and then bombard your warriors down to nothing, and then either say, okay, that's good enough, or now I'm going to press my military advantage, and I'm going to continue on to your land and take it.
You can't get any gold because you can't work any tiles because you don't have food. You can't do anything because you don't have food. I took it all.
You took all of the food. I mean, you would have at least some food.
No, Dan. No. Phil's got all a map script here where you have zero food.
Yeah. You're taking...
This is still a situation where you're just...
Wait, you're actually going for the rational argument approach in this case? Really?
Yes, I am. Just to make you look all the more troll that I am the reasonable one and you are the unreasonable one, and therefore I win, where we can move on. Thank you. All right, good.
Except that you can really get spawns like this. I've seen equivalent versions of these kinds of spawns in all of the Civilization games I've played. It's usually involving a strategic resource screw, but how would you prevent a food screw? You can't. There's no way.
Reroll strategy at that point.
There are always going to be situations where you are screwed, whether we take this approach to food, or as you said, even as the game is now, with all of the measures that are
in place. Let's not raise the odds of having a terrible game because somebody just had no chance at the start. I'd really rather minimize that, if possible.
I'm not convinced that it would necessarily raise it unless you have decided or someone has chosen, hey, let's choose a you know, a map type that's really dry.
Ice Age.
Oh, it's like Ice Age. In other asinine land scripts, say, hey, guys, let's play Tectonic 70% water with 10 sieves. So pro.
Yeah, so, okay, so if you agree to play in that game and you've got this ability for sharing food with an empire, then, okay, I'm going to agree to play in this game, but I recognize that given the setup and also the advantage for being able to have significant amount of food, or at least some advantage for having more food than somebody else, other than the advantages we already have, then you take the risk of getting screwed on that game, just like anybody else would have an equal chance of being screwed.
Entire broadcast is absolutely absolute.
And apparently with 100% less MRAN.
Yes, with 100% less MRAN.
Alright, so why we've been mentioning MRAN, we were hoping to have MRAN on this episode.
Were we?
And
well, you know, fingers crossed, maybe.
Yes, we could have tag-team trolled the world.
It's also a reason why we have Wouter back on here, and also why we have Michael Lucas Smith on here. think we mentioned a few weeks ago that October 2011 marks 5 years since Polycast became publicly known that it existed, as well as our first episode, which was released, in fact, October 20th, 2006, specifically. When we launched then, the original co-hosts were myself, Locutus, Mackie, and Imran. And as for Michael being here, until today, it's been for more than a year, Michael has been tied with one other individual for the most guest appearances on this show. But not anymore, because this is now Michael's 7th appearance on the show. And he was also, as another tie-in, he was our quote-unquote sound engineer for episode 100, which is the first time we did a live show. And now this year, we switched to a live format. Now, I told my fellow panelists that there was going to be a surprise associated with this topic. And one of that has to do with, well, what we used to call the mailbag, and we now call open mic. People actually occasionally write to us, and most of it is positive. And people also respond forum threads, and most of that is positive. But whether it's positive or negative, most of it is on topic. In our first season...
Oh, I think I know what we're going to be doing now.
I wonder who might have picked up on what's going on here.
It's going to be off topic, Mike.
Yes.
Oh, jeez.
We had a couple of wrong numbers to the show. You can listen to them back in episode 9 and episode 19.
Those were great.
What happened, actually, 1 week ago today, you know, I checked the Polycast account, first off, to make sure, you know, that it still existed. But there was a voicemail, and I thought, well, we've had a couple of wrong numbers, and there was no message. And so people probably realized, if they actually got to the end of my 20-second introduction to on our voicemail line, oh, this isn't the person that I actually want. Well, that actually didn't happen in this case. There was actually a message. So I was expecting a question, a comment, you know, a love letter, a poem, something. And instead, listeners, this is what I was greeted with. Now, it is edited to protect the, I was going to say guilty, but that's, you know, they haven't been through a court of law. So to protect the stunned, I have bleeped out certain points.
Hello, this is Jennifer calling. And this message is from in reference to the vehicle you have rented on 17th of September. According to our vacant, this is due for return on 17th of October. I'm unable to extend a contract. Please return to the closest Avis location to extend a contract. If you have any questions, please contact me. My extension is when calling, please use the rental agreement number, which is. Thank you for choosing. Have a nice day.
Has to be automated, right? Has to be.
Yeah.
I was like, wait,
has to be.
I'm dialing a number and reading off a script and not caring what the message I just got was. As if you were actually listening to Dan's voicemail intro thing, you know you were not reaching a person, per se.
It has to be an automated call. It's just the only thing that would allow me to have any faith in humanity at all. And believe me, that's pretty difficult after playing Mafia.
So I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, okay, you know what? I'll do this person a courtesy. Maybe it's towards the end of their shift. They're a little loopy. You know, they're tired. Or perhaps they actually just wanted to troll us. I don't know. Maybe the person actually listens to the show and wanted to see how we would respond. Because, you know, it's not the circumstances in life that define you, but how you respond to them. So I thought, okay, I'm going to phone you back. So
this should be good.
Oh, dear.
Keep in mind, listeners, is how you respond to them. You heard them first.
Dan's response, troll them back.
Dan has been taught how to troll.
Yes.
If you know your party's extension, please dial it now. Otherwise, please leave your name, number, and brief message, and an agent will get back in touch with you.
Your call is being answered by extension. Is not available. To leave a message, wait for the tone. When finished recording, press pound for more options. Record at the tone.
So I was like, no, I'm not going to leave a message because I actually want to talk to a person. I also thought, maybe I don't need to leave a message. Maybe they will realize the error, right? And it was just one person. 2 days later, I checked the voicemail. There's this.
Hello, my name is calling in from. This message is in reference to you'd rented from Avis on 17th of October. Contracts are due only for a maximum of 30 days, but it's passed at this point. Can you please return to the closest location to sign a new rental agreement? If you have any questions, please call me at extension. When calling, please use the rental agreement's number that is. Thank you, Susan. Have a nice day.
So now I've got another person phoning me, and I was frustrated because I actually wanted to have a conversation with this person. And so I thought, I'll try the next day, right? Well, I went to call the next day, except there was another voicemail, which was this.
Hi, this is from. This message is in regards to the rented from. On 17th September, due back on 17th October. Your rental is overdue. I request you to please go into the nearest location and extend the rental. Any further queries, call me on extension. And when calling, please use the references. Thank you for choosing. Have a great day.
What did you rent, Dan?
I've got not one person from this company, not two people, but three people listening to our voicemail prompt about what this is.
And so this is a number that you should be calling to get a recovery of some rented item.
But I'm trying to figure out, if one person makes the call, would it not be in your system that so-and-so called, so that even if you're going to have another agent call, they would reference the previous conversation, that they might actually use some stronger language as well because time has gone by and your rental still hasn't been returned. So I'm not really certain how concerned you are that your rental has not yet been returned.
It has to be a government organization.
So when I call, or at least they've modeled it on that, maybe.
Record at the tone. Facts will be included. To make private, press 1. To make priority, press 2. To no longer include a fax, press 5. Facts will not be included. To make private, press 1. To make priority, press 2. To include a fax, press 5. If finished, press pound. No message to send. To access your mailbox, press star R. If you are finished, please hang up or press star star X. Goodbye.
You have reached an extension of the Loss Prevention Department. I am away from my desk right now. Please leave me your name, rental agreement, or MBA number, your new date of return, and a phone number where you can be reached. I will return your call as soon as possible, or you may press 0 for the next available loss prevention agent. Thank you.
Invalid entry. For help, press star H. Record at the tone. You are recording a message. To bypass voice recording and create a fax-only message, press pound. To record, press 1. After recording, press 1 again. To replay the last few seconds, press 5. To advance a few seconds, press 6. Louder, press 4. Softer, press 7. Faster, press 9. Slower, press 8. To restart at the activity menu, press star R. To have system wait, press star W. To access the names or numbers directory, press star star N. If finished, please hang up, or to disconnect, press star star X.
I still didn't get a person, so I had to leave a voicemail. And as entertaining as it was learning these new voices and names and extensions, I decided that this needed to come to an end. The person listening to this message might be someone that has absolutely no idea what it is that I'm talking about. It could have been any one of those three agents or somebody else.
Record at the tone.
Yes, good evening. I'm calling with regards to rental agreement number... there have been several, three specifically voicemails, one from someone at extension, which redirects to one from, and also one from extension. Again, with regards to this rental agreement, trying to catch the name, either a or a, regards to a rental agreement that two of the messages say start on September 17th and end on October 17th, whereas the first one talked about September 13th and October 13th. This is not the phone number for that individual. This is rather a voicemail message and phone number generally for a Polycast, Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast, which is a family of Civilization Computer Gaming Series podcasts at the polycast.net. I'm not certain where this telephone number was obtained, whether it was from Mr. or Mrs. If it was misquoted or recorded incorrectly, this is not the number for them. I tried phoning back a couple of times, wasn't receiving an answer at any of the extensions, trying to get a hold of the agent that was calling directly. But since we seem to be missing over a number of days here, I decided that I would just leave this message and to please not call this number again, with regards to rental agreement. I did a search for you, a courtesy search on looking for a and found one at in at the phone number. I don't know if this is the person that you are looking for. Again, if I heard the name properly, but that is a potential start. And again, this is not the number for that individual. Thank you very much for your time. Hope you're able to get a hold of a Mr. and get your back. But I'm not the holder of this agreement. And in fact, I have not done business with your company in the past. The only other thing that I would say is it would be helpful to, when pressing zero, when calling your number back, to be able to be sent to the next available agent directly. I tried that and was told that it was an invalid extension. Thanks again for your time. Bye.
Just like calling tech support.
Well, see, I thought I would be polite in the message because I thought if I was a bit too aggressive, then they might actually phone me back just to, you know, actually do some trolling.
Your phone system sucks, P.S.
You're too nice.
They kept saying this name, so I went on to a White Pages directory, and I did a search for the name, and I found someone, and I told them what their address and their phone number was, and as you know, it's kind of like, rather than keep calling me, keep calling the wrong number, maybe here's a lead for actually getting a hold of the person that you want. The timing was so interesting when it's been 5 years since the show went on the air, and for this episode in particular, trying to get all the regular co-hosts back. And Imagina said, are you sure Imran didn't set this up?
Yeah, I was going to say, I could just see that, renting something, putting the Polycast the number in your number.
The answer is no. And you know why? I know that Imran didn't set this up.
Because they weren't looking for him when they asked for the person.
No, because Imran isn't that smart.
Oh. Sing.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Don't listen to Phil!
You should always listen to me. I say very valuable things.
The only way to end the recording properly is to...
Did you purposely stop
talking? Yes, I did, but come on.
Yeah, you just end the sentence in a preposition. You have to make sure you're going to. Yeah. just stop right there at the preposition. It's very important to do that at.
I would like to thank Imran for joining us in this episode today. Imran, you want to say a few words? What's very... that? You're eating food?
Awkward silence. Awkward silence.
You were joined today by myself, MLS, and of course the wonderful Wata Schneider.
Well, bye.
The always fantastic McAllure.
I need more caffeine again.
The always trolltastic Philip Alou.
Be sure to send all dubious good rental inquiries to me. I know how to handle those.
And glorious leader Dan Q.
Did you know that pun spelled backwards is nothing?
Say glorious leader.
Yes, I did know that.
I'll show you enough.
More like inglorious leader.
As long as I'm inglorious, nothing else.
You're an inglorious something.
Recorded October 29th, 2011. Civilization 4, 5, and World Sound Clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.